and that saves lives. I mean, that's just one tiny example of everything that's coming down the pipe.
Well, thank you to the luminous talent that helped produce this show, Gary Niederhoff and Barbara Vance.
Also, thanks to financial support from Rena Schulsky David and Sammy David. Big Picture Science is produced at the SETI Institute, where scientists study the origin and nature of life. And a big thanks also to our listeners.
Your ears have been attuned to the light stuff. If you'd like to hear more Big Picture Science, you'll find more episodes on our archive at bigpicturescience.org.
And if you're a podcast listener, but you prefer listening to over-the-air radio because you're a direct descendant of James Clerk Maxwell or wear his equations on your T-shirt, check out the listing on our website of radio stations that carry the program. And if your local station is not on the list, consider letting them know you like the show.
And do you have a comment, a criticism, or a suggestion? Well, throw in some faint praise and then email it all to bigpicturescience@seti.org.
Hi, this is Pat Frisco with a message that Spirits Rejoice enters its 21st year on the air, continuing the sounds of creative improvised music every Tuesday from 6 until 10 p.m. on this radio station, WHFR Dearborn.
What's up, it's your girl.
The Homelessness Marathon radio broadcast brings the voices of the homeless to the nation.
I'm not giving up, and I don't want nobody to feel sorry for me.
Homeless people deserve housing, not shelters.
And we need housing that people can afford.
What we got here is a problem of human beings being treated like refuse. I think probably the solution is some sort of moral awakening.
On Thursday, January 19th, on the eve of the presidential inauguration, the Homelessness Marathon brings a town hall-style discussion about poverty and homelessness for all Americans to consider. That's the Homelessness Marathon, heard Thursday, January 19th, right here on this radio station.
I wish they would do something about getting people off the streets.
And that's what we're going to talk about today. Welcome to Impact, the show about individuals and groups making a positive difference in the community. The views and opinions expressed on Impact are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio nor Henry Ford College. This is WHFR Dearborn. And we are interviewing or speaking with two wonderful, wonderful people today. Jeremy Alderson, who is the father of the Homelessness Marathon, and Pastor Ronnie Abdumas, a local pastor, and he'll tell us a little bit more about what he does in the area. Okay, Jeremy, are you there?
I am honored to be here, Lynn.
Ah, wonderful. You are there. And Ronnie, can you hear us? Can
yes.
you?
Yes, I can. It's a joy to be here. With
okay. Excellent. All right. Looks like the mechanical part of it or technical part of it is working, maybe. Jeremy, which homelessness marathon is this? I lost track of the numbers.
I sometimes lose track myself. It's the 19th.
Okay. All right. I think I came close on Saturday when I was talking about it. So this is the 19th Homelessness Marathon. It's a little different this year from past years where it's a four-hour broadcast rather than a 14-hour broadcast. But you're in D.C., and there's so much that we can talk about as it relates to the 20th.
Of course. We're not going to be physically in D.C.
Oh, okay.
We're going to be in a studio in Portland, Maine.
Oh, okay.
And we are going to be talking to people, including people in D.C.
Okay.
About the, about everything, about what their hopes are, their fears, how they became homeless, you name it. But this year we're going to be asking them also, well, what do you want to tell the new president?
Okay. All right. And these are just folks who are passing by certain areas or in part of in other radio stations, or where exactly are they coming from?
It's a combination of things.
Okay.
I can tell you some of the schedule if you want to hear it.
Sure.
We haven't released it yet, but for your listeners, why we'll give a preview, Lynn.
All righty.
The first hour will start with Sherry Honkla, who is the head of the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign. She was the Green Party vice presidential candidate in 2012. She's on our board. I've been working with her now for 18 years. And she is going to be with some of the homeless people that the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign works with. So we'll have a whole bunch of people who are homeless there in Philadelphia. And now Sherry, I guess you'd say she's the loyal opposition. Then we'll move on to talk to a woman in Santa Cruz, California, who is homeless. But she's also an activist because in Santa Cruz they're fighting for homeless rights. The fact that that's even a struggle is something that doesn't get much reported. Mm-hmm. Then the next hour we'll talk to Eric Sheptock in Washington, D.C. He's a homeless man living in a shelter, but he's probably also the most prominent homeless activist in D.C. We'll talk to Paul Bowden of the Western Regional Advocacy Project. We'll talk to Robert Warren, who's with People for Fairness in D.C., which is an organization of homeless people. In the third hour, we'll talk to Tasha Lemley, who founded The Contributor in Nashville, which is the most successful of all of the homeless newspapers. And she's going to be somewhere with a group of homeless people live, depending on the weather, inside, outside, we're not sure yet. And so she'll be bringing us the voices of homeless people from Nashville. And also in that hour, we'll talk to Michael Reyes, who's a chef who runs a food truck. He describes himself as a Chicano in Phoenix. But he is defying a ban by the city to feed homeless people for free, and we'll talk to him, and he'll have a couple of people who he refers to as his homies with him. And in the final hour, we're going to talk to a woman we'll call Alice, not her real name, who is in her 60s. She's fully employed. She's, except for a brief period, she was employed all her life. She works for one of the government entities in Southern California. And she's homeless and lives in her car, and they don't even know it when she goes into the government office because the rents are so sky high she can't even with that salary afford to live. And then also in Los Angeles, we'll talk to a group called the Los Angeles Poverty Department, which is a collective mostly, I think, of artists who work with homeless people, and they'll have a group of homeless people with them to talk to in L.A. Plus, of course, we'll take calls.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. If you could kind of refresh from prior years. Some of your stories have been so incredible, and I just wanted to refresh the listeners a little bit. When you talked about things that absolutely hurt my brain to think about, the man who the government went in to clean up the homeless area, and he watched them throw his wooden leg, his prosthetic leg, into the trash can. It just mean-spirited things. And then some of the other places where they've gone in with the front loaders and then just, quote unquote, clean up everything, and people are left with, people who have nothing are left with less than nothing at that point, including things like their identification, their picture IDs, any money that they might have. Could you just talk about some of those from the past?
Sure. And I think you've touched on one of the most important things that people need to understand. The unofficial, not acknowledged, but totally real policy about homelessness all across the United States today is to attack homeless people and hurt them. That is the policy. And this is done in a variety of ways. We can talk about why. It's inhumane. And they city after city bans now the feeding of homeless people. City after city, quote unquote, cleans up encampments and does all of the things you say. And those stories are just for starters. I mean, in Fresno, California, they won a $2.35 million judgment against the city for throwing away the belongings of homeless people. And the only reason maybe it's not as good a precedent is they don't have the same evidence everywhere. There was a videographer who photographed them, with a dumpster load, and you saw some guy's cane hanging off the side of the dumpster. And how could they not see it? It was right there in the camera that they were throwing away a guy's cane. People don't have canes for props, they don't have them for decoration. They knew what they were doing. In that same encampment, there was a horrific story about, they're just human beings, homeless people. The key word is people, not homeless. So there was a guy who had some kittens. He had a cat, had kittens. And after the cleanup, nobody saw the kittens again.
Oh, my God.
you know, they just picked up the tent they were in and threw it in a dumpster. And so these things are horrible. But what you say about the ID is in a way even more horrible. You can't access any services at all without an ID. You can't go and get your food stamps. You can't get your veterans check. So what they do when they throw that stuff away is they throw away a person's only tool of survival. It's like throwing away somebody's source of fire when they're camping in the winter. You're making it almost impossible. And one thing you didn't list that they also throw away is people's medication.
I mean,
can you imagine? They take your medication, then they take away your identification so you can't get more medication. So it's just unbelievable cruelty, and it isn't happening by coincidence. If HUD wanted to stop it, it would be stopped in a second.
Wow. Every time we talk about these facts, I'm left speechless, and that's hard to do. Ronnie, any comments?
It is, and you know what I fight in my job is getting too used to it. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
It's just I hear it every day. I hear it all the time. I live with it, but I have, thank God it still affects me.
Right, Ronnie.
So yeah, I mean, just you know, this past week. With this cold, bitter weather and temperatures that we've had, you know, being at home and inside the buildings and you're shivering, and it just makes you think and even pray more for those who don't even have a place to stay and what that would be like. I want to say something. A couple of weeks ago, you know, we just celebrated Christmas, and the story of homelessness doesn't begin and doesn't end just with humanity. One of the things that's amazing to me, throne of heaven as we celebrate Christmas in the form of Jesus Christ, but yet Jesus comes on earth and there is no place for him, no room at the inn, right? And for most of his ministry, Jesus was really with no place, traveling and doing the work that God has called him to do. For us to think of, you know, the place and what it means to us, land and home has been something that identifies us and shapes us. And for someone, just like you have said, Jeremy, to lose their being, to lose their identity, to lose everything that they got. One story that has come to my mind as I'm listening to you of a specific member in our community, that this is a Christian Middle Eastern member who, you know, they've immigrated, they've come to this country, things were fine the first couple of years, but then when the source of income, the man of the house had left the house, then all of a sudden they were on the street. And they had to travel from place to place. They were living in their car. You're talking about 3-4 member family that just living in the car. And they would stop at the rest stops, you know, to eat and to wash and to bathe. And then when they tried to work, the girl in the family tried to work, the mother tried to work. They would the one of the children had a serious illness, and they would go to the, you talk about hurting homeless, it's an interesting twist how you say it, but sometimes whether I don't think we intend to do it, I would like to think we don't intend to hurt homeless people as a government, as a system, but the nature of what we're doing, our actions are hurting them. So for example, trying to receive just some benefits to help this person in their times of illness, which they would qualify for, would not qualify them because they didn't have a physical address. I mean, literally, you know, this lady, I remember her story. Every time I hear her story, every time I just say, where's justice in this? And she would be sent out because you don't have a physical address. Well, that's why I'm coming to you. I'm coming to seek assistance for a family member who's ill because I don't have any other means. But instead of helping them, we get stuck on this technicality. I need a physical address. And then for that reason, they couldn't get the treatment for this person. And eventually this person would die at the age of 30. And of course, it doesn't get easier for the family afterwards. And it just gets harder and harder. So you talk about this cycle, a vicious cycle, right? It starts with, you know, one thing leading to another, and then all of a sudden you don't have your ID, you don't have your forms, it gets more complicated. And instead of making things easier where we can help people, we end up hurting them, as you said earlier.
Jeremy?
I would be curious to know from Father Ronnie if homeless people are being harassed in Dearborn.
So here's the thing. One of the things in the Middle Eastern community, I mean, you know, you talk about those taboos, right? The every community, every culture, there are things that people don't talk about. And homelessness, you know, it's kind of like to bring a Middle Eastern person to talk about their experiences or homelessness. Perhaps it becomes like as if they feel they are, it's a shameful place to be, right? And for them, I mean, I've tried to invite somebody to come with me today, and kind of like the first reactions I got from that individual is, this is not something I want to brag about. This is not something I feel. And some feel that they are at fault, or somehow they haven't achieved the success that the world is telling them about. So it becomes harder. Now, in terms of harassment, so it's not like you walk on the streets of Dearborn and you find people on the street. Although Michigan, we know that we are number one in the Midwest in terms of number of homeless people in general, and the fifth in the country or so. Now, this is like older statistics, but we're up there in the nation. And when you look at statistics, it doesn't mention Middle Easterns. Part of the reason is Middle Eastern people have associated themselves as, quote, white, Caucasian and white. I mean, there is no category. Actually, the 2020 census, there has been like a movement through community leaders to change this category. So there will be something that hopefully will say Middle Eastern to identify people more in terms of categories. But so it's hard to say how many Middle Eastern homeless people there are. But from my experiences in pastoral ministry, I've come across many people who are facing homelessness, and others who are simply, I would say, a thin wall between them and homelessness. So, for example, 11 people right down the street from where we are here at this station, right? Mm-hmm. I have 11 people who are living in a one-bedroom house, and they don't have income, they don't have support. Now, they managed to get this house, you know, on a very basic payment, whatever, they're putting everything to keep that place over their head. But in my opinion, they're just as homeless as the next person. They don't have food on the table. They don't have any of their basic supplies, and they suffer in that way. Are people harassed for being homeless, for just being Middle Eastern? I think the question is deeper, which comes to the point of what we're seeing and facing of the targeting of the Middle Eastern community, the Muslim community, and others, just because of this association with terrorism and the fear of where people are coming from. I think the whole refugee crisis, I mean, look at refugees, they are homeless to begin with, right? They've been displaced in their own land as groups of people. They're homeless, and they're trying to come over here to find a home or any other place in the world for that matter. We're only taking the smallest portion in terms of refugees when you look at the world countries and Europe and others, and how do we help in this humanitarian crisis. This is a global crisis. Mm-hmm. This is not a Syria issue, a Jordan issue, an Iraq issue. This is a global crisis. And for us to take part in it, not only makes sense, but I believe it's an obligation for us as a nation when you talk about the global scheme of things. So I think it leaves us to conclude, rather than I want to say that there has been documented cases of people. I think kind of like, Jeremy, what you said yourself one time, homelessness doesn't distinguish between Muslim, Christian, Middle Eastern, Hispanic, Latino. I mean, a homeless person is a homeless person facing those challenges.
A person first. Yeah. Tell me a little bit more about the family you just referred to a bit ago with regards to having 11 people in one room and nothing, really. How are they getting by? You can only go so long without food and water.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the pain of the mother, like we tried to collect some food the other day, and that was one of the first places we dropped over Christmas. Mm-hmm. But the mother, just to simply think, I mean, you could see the tears in her eyes, just thinking how to feed her children. And to this, I want to say that, you know, part of the stereotype, like earlier, Lynn, we were kind of chatting on this, is that, you know, people think all the Middle Eastern community, the Arabs, they're the rich people, they're wealthy people, they come with oil and, the petroleum connection to it, or some of those stereotypes that are just mind-boggling that people still believe them. Now, sure, there are wealthy people in the Middle Eastern community.
Of course.
Sure, there are wealthy people in every single community. But to say that the whole community is wealthy, that is not just an understatement. That is a fallacy that we cannot, do anything with. I mean, there are a lot of people who are barely making ends meet. I have people in my congregation who work day and night trying to support their big family of five or six from 14 to 15 hours, and the money that they're making is just barely making ends meet. I look at it as homelessness being a way, couple paychecks from where they're at,
right,
in that sense.
Yeah. And Jeremy, you're talking about somebody who actually has a government job, which is supposed to be, ultimate. And
maybe a low level of the government, but that's
right.
Another matter.
Well, but she's...
it's confidential, obviously. We can't reveal who she is. Yes, and I'd like to expand on that and expand on something you asked me earlier, which is the memorable moments. And I want to share with you both and the audience, listening audience, one of the most memorable moments of all for me in the 18 years I've done this marathon. And it's one that illustrates such an important principle that applies really to everything. The last time I was in Portland, Maine, then we weren't in the studio, then we were on the street, it was organized differently, and I had a panel of disabled homeless vets. One had diabetes, one had spinal degeneration, one was going blind, and I asked them, I said, could you guys, you guys have disability, could you be faking it, And they said, well, we've been inspected. I said, you've been inspected by a doctor? He said, yeah, and not even our doctor. We were all inspected by the doctor that the government sent us to. And so they were all certified by a government doctor as telling the truth. They were really disabled and they were really vets and they were getting disability. But none of them could afford housing with the disability they were getting. These are the truly needy of the neediest. And although I don't think veterans are necessarily like better people than anybody else or anything like that, we can debate when they go into a war or go into the military, but our obligation to them when they come out is incontrovertible. And so here they are, three disabled veterans not getting enough money for housing. And so just being a host, and trying to bring something out in my guests, I turned to the three of them and I said, well, hey, okay, you're disabled vets, you haven't got enough money for housing. Did you ever try walking into the local Department of Social Services or whatever they call it here in Maine and say to them, look, I'm a homeless disabled vet and I'm not getting enough money. Could I have some more to make my expenses? And their answer to that was the longest, most raucous, most heartfelt laughter we ever had on the show. They thought that was the funniest idea. They couldn't get over what an idea it was to go in and tell the government office, we don't have enough money to live and hope to get any more. And that's the problem, which is that even when we have a solution, in quotes, where we're giving money to our disabled homeless vets, it's inadequate. Resources for the people are inadequate across the social spectrum. People have to go out and get two or three jobs. They have to take on debt in order to go to school. People are struggling everywhere, while, as we know, the rich are getting richer and richer and richer, and they're getting all the money. This is why you have discontent. This was something that was said on the Bernie Sanders on the Democratic side, and it's something that's been said by Trump. So whichever side of it all you are on, it's all become one-sided, and the bottom line is people are fighting for resources, and it makes it harder for everybody, no matter if they're Muslims in Dearborn or disabled vets in Maine. Everybody is facing a harder task because the water is drying up at the water hole. And so that's really a background to the problem of homelessness that you just can't ignore. It's that funds have been slashed. That's really what's happening, and it's throwing people out on the streets.
And how do we stop that?
realistically, I don't think we're going to stop that. I do think that there is a easy solution to homelessness. I don't believe that homelessness is some difficult problem to solve. I think that's just propaganda. But do I seriously believe that there is a chance we're going to have a government in Washington that is going to address the problem properly? I don't think we would have gotten that from Hillary Clinton. I don't think we'll get it from Donald Trump. It's not even on the agenda. Poverty isn't, you know, even the Democrats, they talk about the middle class. That's the whole cornerstone of everything, is saving the middle class. And they're not even talking about giving a life preserver to the lower class. They're not talking about the poor or the homeless. They're saying, oh, well, we'll try and save the middle class. At this point, it is not in the political discourse of the United States to talk about poverty. It's tragic.
So it's somewhat interesting, Jeremy, that Trump did address, I think, in a different kind of connotation, the inner cities, right? This is one of the things that it was more like in a stereotypical manner. Some have perceived it as stereotyping certain groups or backgrounds, but there's no doubt that, you know, talk about unequal distribution of resources, right? And the willingness, when we talk about, you know, in our faith communities, talk about generosity and sharing the blessing that God has given us. For one person to, you know, share a million, that's kind of radical. But for a million people to share a dollar, that's not much. And that's doable, right? And you know, from our listeners and everyone else to get $1, that's a million right there in no time. So the question is, who's willing to give, right? And who's willing to make that change? I believe that we do have the power to make that change if we commit and understand. And that's why I really appreciate the work that you're doing, because for so often we forget about, you know, the homeless. When I was in Philadelphia, I was in New York, other places. I mean, you talk about the cities where, you know, homeless people are, you know, that image I can't take off my mind when you go into the subways and people are running to their daily life and the rush of their daily life and their business, and they pass by almost like body bags, right? Bodies laying on the street, covered by blankets as if they do not exist. What would make this person less of a human being than you? Is it the fact that some have money and some don't? And we all know that many people who are homeless are educated and well-educated, and they've lost their jobs, and like we said, a couple paychecks away from homelessness, anyone many people can fall into that category, given how much debt we have accumulated and the lifestyles that many live where we are in debt. You fall back on payments. One specific lady in my mind, again, not too far from here, she, you know, with this home crisis, the crash of the market back in 2008, she lost her home. She didn't pay for a couple of years. She ended up literally on the street. And she was somebody who was making everything on time, trying to do her best. And she didn't have the network and the support. And understand, a lot of the immigrants who are here who do not even understand or speak the language well or know how to fill those forms, complicated forms, or ask for whatever is needed, I see them more falling into this category by default at a much faster rate.
I think that's true. Everybody's maybe one paycheck away from a big problem. Personally,
can I jump in on that?
Sure.
Can I jump in and make a point here, which is, I think that Father Ronnie is exactly right, that people have to open their hearts and take action based on that. If people don't do that, forget it. The rest of it, there's no hope. Doesn't matter what you propose. People don't care and have that connection to their fellow human beings. At the same time, that connection of the heart, in my opinion, has to take many forms. It certainly can take the form of charity. It certainly can take the form of volunteering. It can take the form of just being one-on-one and just talking to a homeless person you might ever run into and asking them how they're doing, like they're a human being. And it also, I feel, must take the form of insisting that when we as human beings organize as a government or an entity, that we have principles, that people cannot be left to just fall through the bottom, that we have to have a principle, that there has to be a level that we don't let happen to people. And we shouldn't be letting people die on the streets. That should be something we all agree on, and that should be something that is a mandate of our government, because that reflects the common will of the people, or at least it should.
Right. A number of years ago, one of the marathons talked to another country, and I don't remember the country that it was, and the question was, how do you handle your homelessness? And the answer is, we don't have any. And the reason that there wasn't any homelessness in that country is that the government did not want their homelessness to be an embarrassment to the country. Do you know the country I'm talking about?
Lynn, I know just how you feel. Those countries all start to look alike to me after a while, too.
I want to say Norway, but I'm not positive.
No, well, it's not. It's,
okay.
It's Switzerland is the actual
Switzerland.
One that you're
okay.
referring to.
Okay.
And the thing, one of the radical things that they say in Switzerland, and the other countries in like Scandinavia, they're similar. But anyway, this was Switzerland you're referring to.
Okay.
One of the things that they say is it costs more money to rehabilitate somebody once they're on the street than to keep them in their homes. This is, in fact, universally acknowledged to be true everywhere. And so they say to themselves, I'm not even getting to the humanitarian part, they say to themselves, let's save ourselves a little money, and let's keep the people in their houses. So the incredible thing is, in Switzerland, if you go to the social welfare office, it's the opposite of what I described with the laughing vets. You go to the social welfare office and you say, I can't pay my rent anymore, they'll pay it for you. And the thing that the guy I had on, the head of the Swiss Social Welfare Federation, he was talking about it, and he said, you know, one of the things he said was exactly as you say. If people ever saw a homeless family on the streets of a Swiss city, they'd call the authorities. They'd call the authorities. These are my words, not his. They'd call the authorities from the way he was just like talking like it's incredible. You could never have that. He was talking about it like if a bunch of crack dealers showed up in an upscale neighborhood and everybody'd be calling the police. He just talked about it like that, like you couldn't have that on a Swiss city. It would be an affront to everybody. And that's, we're so far from that. It's, you know, it's sad. And maybe we'll come to this, though. You know, maybe we'll have hard times and we'll come to it. I wouldn't wish it on anybody because times are hard enough. But maybe we'll have an awakening somehow in this country. That's all I can hope for.
Mm-hmm.
And Jeremy, perhaps that makes us wonder, when we talk about individualism and the sense of some other cultures have more a sense of connectedness and family-oriented, which means that one would look after the other. I think, you know, when we look at our context so often, I mean, generally speaking, of course, that it seems like really, I mean, a lot of people feel they're on their own. And you know, if you can't make it yourself, then nobody's going to chip in for you. I always say, when people are trying to impress others, I say, who's paying $1 of your energy bill that you're trying to impress? Who's really paying your bills? I mean, you're on your own. The other day, my wife was at one of the stores where an individual, literally, I mean, 11 cents. All he had was a gallon of milk, some bread. Going out, the cashier wouldn't let him go for 11 cents. She had to page the manager. They're up and down, and you know, my wife was all frustrated with the situation. Just went out to help the guy for a couple cents. But it is ridiculous that we throw so much stuff. I mean, look how much food we throw away. Look at the places. You know, I see sometimes individuals coming to ask for a bowl of soup, right, or whatever it is at some of those places that cater. We don't even have to mention their names. At the end of the day, they're dumping all the stuff out, right? But they won't give a piece of bread to someone who would just go in because they have nothing. You talk about, you know, the wealthy getting wealthier, the poor getting poorer, but yet somebody who's wealthy enough for spending $100, here's an extra $10 just for you for spending the money that as a reward. And I think that's where the systematic approach does make a difference. I believe we have enough resources. not just in this country, but globally, in the whole world. I really believe when we talk about poverty in other countries, when we talk about in places like Africa and Ethiopia and places where people, I mean, literally are trying to, I don't know if you've ever seen those documentaries, they're trying to find dirt in the soil to eat. I mean, literally. I mean, you know, you look at an image like this, you cannot get out of your mind. They're looking for the dirt in the soil just to pick anything so they can chew on, right? And then you look at the multi-billion dollar accounts that go in, you know, this place and that place, and you look at somebody just, you know, even the lottery system, right? Here's 300 million. Well, I say give somebody $1 million and use another 299 to feed the homeless. I mean, you know, I think anybody would be happy to win the lottery for $1 million. Why do you have to give out 300 million? Take 299 and end homelessness in one section of a town. That should be sufficient to establish programs. I think it's our approach. I think we have the resources. We have the brains to do it. We have the capabilities and the means, but the will doesn't seem to be there.
It's the
well, I certainly agree with that. I certainly agree with that, and I think that just by, the really scarce resource around the world is not shelter or food, although that's scarce in a lot of places. The one that's really critically short is safe water, which is not a problem that applies to most of the United States yet. So I think that one of the things that's interesting to me, though, Father and Lynn, is that we all agree that if we looked at it from a more communitarian point of view, caring for one another, things would get better. But let's just take a moment and look at it from a super individualistic point of view. Let's look at it from the point of view of somebody who says the country should be run so a man can go out there and earn his daily bread and make things for himself, and he shouldn't be given a handout, and he shouldn't be given this. Let him fend for himself. Well, the funny thing is that if you look at it that way, then logically and philosophically and morally, you have to say that people have to be given a chance to survive. You have to have a legal place where a person can pitch a tent, where a person can have a little, you know, place to be. You can't be having a police force that their duty is to keep people from fending for themselves, to keep people from surviving. So it doesn't really matter in a very ironic way whether you would be extremely on the communitarian side or on the individualistic side. There's no moral viewpoint that can justify our current policy. Our current policy isn't based on morality. It's based on other factors, most notably greed and a feeling of we're not going to spend the money to do for our society because other people have their hooks in and want the money for themselves. So I think that's really what's going on.
I think at the root of all of it, though, is the we-they mentality that we have so prevalent in this country and possibly other places. But I can speak to this area, not the U.S., where you talk about we are hardworking, blah, 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 and they are just out to scam the system. They are looking for a handout. They are looking for a free ride. And there's no, I guess I'd use the word forgiveness in the fact that somebody either made a bad decision or didn't have a decision to make and just ended up in a bad place, because that kind of thing does happen. You take a couple, for example, and they both have reasonable jobs, or worse yet, he's the sole support and decides to walk out, and where is she? And a lot of times the woman ends up in a homeless situation, not due to anything that she's ever, you know, no fault of hers, but she doesn't have a job history. She doesn't have that because that's not where her life was. Her life was being the support system for this man. And now all of a sudden he decides he's leaving, probably for somebody younger, editorial comment. And then you have this female who is in a really bad place. So what did she do that was so wrong? Trust somebody?
I've got a picture on my wall that I'm looking at this very minute, Liz,
okay,
of me at the marathon sitting next to a woman who was my co-host for that hour. And that was her story. She had said that she was wealthy, and that she was the woman who organized the food drive for the poor.
Oh, wow.
But that after her divorce, She wound up having to rely on food pantries. Her husband had the money. He had the lawyers. She lost out in the settlement, and she's broke. Happens all the time. And yes, you're right. There's no crime attached to it. But why not go to the other extreme? I was in a homeless shelter in Cleveland when this mother and two kids came in, and the kids were young and they were frightened, and I went over to them and I talked to them. And I said to them, you know, I don't know how you got here, but you should just remember that it's not your fault, because if you just happened to have been in another country and something had happened, you had a medical thing, you lost your job, whatever, they wouldn't let you be out here like this. It's not you, not your fault. And she turned to the kids and she said, you hear that? Because that's what homeless people feel, just like what Ronnie was saying, Father Ronnie was saying, is that they feel like, oh, it must be something wrong with me. But it's really more right now like we've got some kind of plague that's contagious and people are catching it. And one of the things that I said right almost from the beginning of the broadcast, I think I said it on the very first one, I said, when the canary dies in the coal mine, it's not a veterinary problem. It's not about, oh, that poor canary. It's about, oh, my God, what does that mean when the canary is dying in the coal mine? That's what it's like with homelessness. Homelessness is a sign of something terribly wrong in the richest nation on earth. It shouldn't exist. The minute it started to exist, we should have had a national inquiry. How is this happening? The same way we would have if we'd had Ebola breakout somewhere.
Right.
But we didn't.
Well, one of the pictures I have in my brain goes back to 09 when you were in Detroit. And there was a very tall mother with, I think the little guy was about 2 years old. So he was on the ground and her face was way up in the sky because she was a tall person. And the camera kept panning up and down, up and down. Finally, somebody had her pick up her son so that you could see both faces in the same frame. And if you want to blame her for whatever it is you want to blame her for, how can you possibly blame this little two-year-old precious gift from God for the problems?
Of course.
So
another thing, Jeremy, you know, when we look at the, just for a moment there, to think of the global perspective and the world, and I mean, sometimes if it's just that hard, when we talk about homelessness in our context, and sometimes how it's just a matter of, you know, losing a job or, you know, due to a family breakup, etc. Just imagine all the other circumstances that add to that when you look at the context and places of war and conflict. And I mean, just like, you know, you think of what's happening in the world around us today and the humanitarian crisis. And not just you talk about one or two people who are homeless, but you talk about millions who have been displaced from their homes, that homes have been demolished. Simply they are just out on the street and it's just like an exodus of people. It's just heartbreaking to see those who are experiencing homelessness in a whole, I mean, sometimes we don't look at it perhaps as homelessness, but it's homelessness in a collective manner, where you got, you know, thousands and tens of thousands of people on the run, on the move, and they're living in, you know, whether it's tents or camps or even no place and no shelter. And think of the children in all this. So it's just really mind-boggling for a second, even to think of what's happening in the world around us. And I think that's where the obligation becomes, as we think of how can we end homelessness here in our cities, in our states, in our country, in our nation. But also we think, how do we share the blessings that we already have in welcoming others and helping others in their homelessness and receive them in that sense?
Did you tweet the Donald to invite him to take a listen?
No, I don't really. You know, I would I would be happy to tell him, you know, what I think he ought to do. And in fact, if he called in, if Obama called in, or if Bush had called in during the years we were doing that, we started in the Clinton administration, I might have had a word or two to say to them about, you know, maybe you ought to change this or that. But if Donald Trump called in, he hadn't done anything yet. I'd be happy to talk to him, but I don't think I'm going to get the chance.
Well, he's big on the tweeting and all that nonsense.
I don't even know how to tweet. I've never done even a text in my entire life. I'm an old guy. I'm old enough now I can say, I don't know about all this newfangled stuff.
What do you think is your primary hope for this particular marathon? It's lighter number of hours. We're only 4 hours versus the 14. It's going to be different from past marathons. What do you hope to accomplish with this one?
Well, this isn't a very PR kind of answer, but the truth is we just hope to survive.
Okay, that's fair.
We hope to do a good broadcast. And we hope to live to be able to do a broadcast another day. But I think the very depressing thing about doing the broadcast or being a homeless advocate of any stripe is that things are just getting worse and worse. So to do this kind of thing means you're continually failing. That's all we're doing. We're just failing. We're putting a message out there and things just get worse. We say, don't do this, and they do it. So that's really, really depressing. So, you know, we just are going to do our jobs. And from our point of view, it's nice to do just 4 hours because it's easier for us and less strain, and it's at a good time before the thing. And we hope, that's all we can hope for, though. We're just doing our jobs. That's it. And we just hope we do a good job, and we can do it again.
Okay. Possibly getting the word out there will one of these times fall on the correct ears, if you will, and someone may think, gee, there is something I can do based on my position in the government or whatever it might be, letter writing campaign or anything. If somebody's inspired, then, you know, thank you for that.
Well, you never know. I mean, we do it because we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And because we, you know, better to light a candle in the dark than to curse the darkness, or however that saying goes. We're happy to do it. But I can't be telling people, it's like you could be an activist for on either side, let's say, of the abortion issue. And you could say, why, if we win, we're going to shut down all the abortion clinics. And somebody else will say, we're going to expand women's opportunity to choose. And both sides will have victories, and both sides will have their platforms. Really, in the homeless field, it's not so much like that.
Right.
We're just taking a terrible beating. We're just losing. There may be a little victory here and there, but we're just losing. City after city is attacking homeless people. How many times can you get out there and scream? Don't, what are you, crazy? Don't do that. It's like watching a mother beat her child and you can't stop it. It's horrible.
Are any of the cities where you have representation, any of those California cities in particular, any of the places that have been so cruel to homeless?
Oh, well, yeah, sure. Santa Cruz is one that, when I was out there, my host was showing me around, you know, where they put spikes. They have little trees in the downtown, and then they have like a little, the way it is, like a concrete planter around the trees that people used to sit on, and they put spikes on them so you couldn't sit down.
Jeez, okay.
You know? We have people on... from Washington, D.C., where they shut down the biggest shelter and they haven't replaced it, and they already had a big problem. Yes, we'll be Los Angeles is the city. We'll have a lot of reports from there, some stuff, which is the city which is, it's maybe the most completely out of control in the entire country, but not necessarily one of the cruelest, but they're pretty cruel, but they're just overwhelmed. So I think people will find, if you want a smattering of that stuff, yes, I think you'll find that in the well represented in the show.
Hmm. Well, I know that in the past you have had some of those stories and you have been in some of those places, so I was curious. Wow.
So the heart of this, Jeremy, also as you talk, how do we inspire others, and with the work that you do, trying to speak to people's hearts, I cannot but help think about this, the story of Cain and Abel, and familiar to all faith traditions. And one of which, here is, after Cain had killed Abel out of the jealousy and the story that we remember. You know, he's going around, and when God, you know, he runs away, he tries to run away from God. And when God asks him, well, where is your brother, or what have you done with him? He says, well, how should I know? Am I my brother's keeper? And I think this invitation has been from the beginning of humanity, the beginning of history, only two people on earth, technically. I mean, you know, just like think of it in that sense, I guess. And they're already fighting and killing each other. But the other part is, you know, am I my brother's keeper? Why should I care? And I think that's the greater question for all of us, is for anybody to move from their warm, comfortable place on a day like today and do something, whether write a letter or make a donation or help somebody else, they have to ask themselves and must be asking themselves, why should I care? And unless I think we answer that question for ourselves individually, each of us, whether, you know, it's because my motivation is I want to please God in my relationship with God, I want to do that, or it's because I really care for other human beings and I'm not the only one on earth, whatever it is, unless we answer that question to ourselves, we will not move from our place. And at the end, if we do answer it and realize that I am the one who's going to be my brother's keeper, I'm the one, why should I care about people dying in Africa, or why should I care about people dying in war zones in the Middle East, or why should I care about this or that? Well, you know, I'm part of this world. I don't live on my own. I'm not in isolation. The good that I make, the good that I do here, will multiply even for not just for myself, for my family, for my community. I create a better world by starting to do something right now.
Right. And if everybody does a little bit, if a million people give $1, it doesn't hurt any of those people. And you can potentially help so many others. So,
I'm a religious person myself, but I would like to just jump in and say that an atheist also could have every kind of good impulse and good insight and wisdom about this situation. I am a religious person, but I don't want to make it think like this is just for religious people. This
right,
is for
right.
everybody. And in fact, I like to have it thought of in a way, you know, if somebody thinks I'm a bad person, as far as I'm concerned, that's kind of good for the movement, because it just shows you that bad people can give a damn too. I don't think you have to be a saint to be...
But you know, Jeremy, it might be interesting, I think, for others also to know that non-religious people actually, you know, it's documented that they give more than religious people. I mean,
really?
In terms of charities or donations or volunteering, non-religious people have done more than religious people.
Well, having said that, let me tell you, if I may, I'll tell you a story which we had on last year's marathon, which people may have heard, but probably most people haven't, and it's a pretty amazing story. But and I'm just telling it to you as a factual matter, not because I'm trying to convince anybody of anything. This is just the facts.
Okay.
In Nashville, there was a guy sitting on the sidewalk with some of his other homeless friends. And he had his guitar case open, and he had a sign on it that said something like, homeless musician, you know, please help. So that may not have been the exact words, but it was something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just the facts of the matter. More than 20 years on the streets, and had just 2 weeks before prayed to God and said, please help me, I'm going to stop. And so he was 2 weeks sober, and he's just sitting there like he had been sitting there for 20 years in one city or another. And a couple of people, man and a woman, they look like tourists, come up, and there's somebody else with a camera, but it just looks maybe like a holiday, you know, three people out, you know, one of them's filming the happy couple, who knows. And they come up to him and they say, oh, you're a musician, could you play us a song? So he plays them a song, which is something he wrote, and it turns out these two people are from Swedish television. And overnight, the song becomes a hit in Sweden, and the next thing you know, he's playing with famous musicians, including Emmy Lou Harris, who's famous here, and touring around Europe. This all happened like that, like really quickly. But he's just a guy who 1 minute is just sitting on the street with an open guitar case.
Mm-hmm.
And now this is a wealthy guy playing all over the world. So
wow.
It's just a story of what can happen.
Yeah. Wow. Well, we'll have to make all your guests famous.
Well, you know, I do believe miracles do happen. Again, I'm not trying to sell this as a religious thing. I'm just trying to say, hey, you know, this is the real world we live in.
Yes.
Amazing things happen whether you believe in God or not. To me, it's not important. Amazing things happen. We have a capacity to do good as well as a capacity to do harm. We have a capacity to care about each other as well as to turn our backs against each other. And maybe we can find the best part of what we are.
Right. You know,
what's the big deal about that?
Not. It's logic. I was just thinking, what about the each one of those workers, whatever you're working for, whether it's a city or a county or what have you, and you're going in with the front loaders and on and on and on, are you aware of any of them who have, like, stood their ground and say, no, I'm not going to do this? That's the guy's walking cane. You know, I'm not going to pick up that piece, and I'm not going to destroy this tent. Has anybody actually revolted against doing some of the horrible things that we know have been done?
We don't have a registry for this anywhere, so this is just stuff I've heard.
Right.
And I know in the incident you're talking about, I had that same question, and these guys are in a union.
Okay.
And so why doesn't the union pass the word or do something?
Sure.
And the answer is because the union has the same kind of anti-homeless feeling as the rest of the city administration. So on the one hand, the people doing it may have this, they may think they're cleaning out the bums. I don't know what they think, but they may not be thinking any different from the mayor. On the other hand, in Kansas City, I know, for instance, they had one police chief who refused, he told the city council he wouldn't enforce an anti-panhandling ordinance because he thought it was interfering with people's free speech, and he just wouldn't do it. So there are occasions where people dissent, but it's I don't think that's the norm by a long shot.
Yeah, but that's encouraging. Just to know somebody's out there who cares enough to say, no, this is wrong, I'm not going to do it. So.
Absolutely. Everyone. Like, just same as talking on the radio. You don't know who you're affecting. He did a good thing. Who knows what would have happened if he'd enforced it? All the people that might have been damaged by it that weren't.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So I would, if I may, Lynn, say one word about the solution to homelessness.
Please.
I think that one of the things people should understand is it would be really simple to immediately ameliorate the problem. And remember, as with all problems, just because you've taken one step doesn't mean you're done. You know, you want to win a war, you want to win a basketball game, you want to win the struggle with homelessness, you got to have more than one play. You got to have more than one arrow in the quiver. So I don't want to make it sound easy. It's something that it's a process. But the first thing that needs to be done is there has to be a place in every city in the country where a person can pitch a tent, or if you have you're living in your car, where you can pull up and park legally, like some abandoned supermarket, for instance, where you've got a big parking lot. Every city almost has got them, and so you should be able to come up onto that parking lot and pull in your truck or pitch a tent or do something, and inside the city can put up showers, and they can put a social services outreach thing, and they can put in, you know, toilets, and that's so much cheaper by every measure than policing the problem. And that's what the first thing that they should do. So, and they should be places where people have rights. They can be regular neighborhoods with police patrols, fire lanes, all of that. And people should have rights, just like any other neighborhood, so that if you arrest a guy over here who's living in a tent, doesn't mean you tear down the whole neighborhood. You just arrest the perpetrator the same as you would anyplace else.
Right.
So this is the first step. And the way to pay for it, remember, this is the money-saving step. This is like 10% of the cost of all of the failed policies. And the way to pay for it is for HUD to simply say no money for any city until they have fulfilled this basic requirement. And then we'll allocate funds for all the other things we do, like housing and so forth, and we'll prorate it. But you get all of the first money we send you, no matter what the purpose is. It has to go to making sure there is a safe place for everyone to be, so no one is dying on the streets who doesn't have some other illness, but that we're not killing our own citizens. We're respecting their rights and they're giving them an opportunity to survive. That's what has to happen first. After right. that, many other steps, but that's what has to happen.
And the supplement to that, Jeremy, on the long term is, again, to create, look into legislation and policies and create the affordable housing, affordable mm-hmm. health care, affordable means of living that we can target and then change so that people don't have to face those situations in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. We have just another minute or so. Any parting words, Jeremy?
Well, I hope you'll everybody tune in to the Homelessness Marathon on Thursday the 19th from 7 to 11 p.m. on this very station, WHFR. That's the most important thing right now, I can say.
Okay.
And, the other thing I would say is, hey, there used to be a saying in the 60s, keep on trucking. If we believe in doing right, we just have to do it. Just have to do it, whether we're worthy to do it or not, whether we feel like it or not. We just have to keep going.
Right. Okay. Ronnie, you have you 30 seconds.
30 seconds. I would say, again, although, as you had mentioned, faith is not necessarily what could motivate a lot, I believe, at the end of the day, God will change our hearts, and I believe that no matter where you are in your life, if you look at your fellow human being and see them suffering, it's hard to sleep at night knowing that someone else is out in the cold. And just, feeling for others and doing our part makes a big difference. But thank you for your efforts and for the work you've done, and thank you, Lynn, for the time you've given us here today.
Thank you so much.
My thanks to both of you as well.
Thanks, Jeremy and Ronnie. Thanks for being here today on Impact. And thank you all for listening to Impact, the show about individuals and groups making a positive difference in the community. The views and opinions expressed on Impact are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio nor Henry Ford College. And this is WHFR Dearborn.
The Homelessness Marathon radio broadcast brings the voices of the homeless to the nation.
I'm not giving up, and I don't want nobody to feel sorry for me.
Homeless people deserve housing, not shelters.
And we need housing that people can afford.
What we got here is a problem of human beings being treated like refuse. I think probably the solution is some sort of moral awakening.
On Thursday, January 19th, on the eve of the presidential inauguration, the Homelessness Marathon brings a town hall-style discussion about poverty and homelessness for all Americans to consider. That's the Homelessness Marathon, heard Thursday, January 19th, right here on this radio station.
I wish they would do something about getting people off the streets.
Criminal justice studies are concerned with the preservation of peace, the prevention of crime, and the protection of life and property. A knowledge of the role of criminal justice in our society also serves to emphasize